Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we've got an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, right now, folks, I am in Indianapolis, Indiana. Actually, I am at the Indy 500 as I speak, even though I pre-recorded this on Saturday. This is going to be a very motorsports-centric show today, talking about the Indy 500, the Coke 600, as well as the Monaco Grand Prix. We're going to catch you up on all the drama that has been happening at Indianapolis, and a lot of people have lost their jobs here over the course of the last four or five days, so we'll talk about that as well. Of course, we'll talk about gas prices, some weird and unusual automotive news, and of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. Well, as I mentioned last week, my wife and I and our little dog, Brandy, ventured back out to Indiana. Both Janine and I grew up in Indiana, went to school at Purdue, and are big Indy 500 fans. Well, the reality is I'm probably a bigger fan, but she appreciates my enthusiasm. So drove across country, stopped in Amarillo, spent the night, went to the Big Texan, one of my favorite places to go get a meal. Then we made our way to Springfield, went through some major storms. In fact, the hotel we were staying at lost power and was on generator power when we woke up the next morning, and then made it to Indianapolis. Went to Carburetor Day, and I have some sounds from Carburetor Day to play for you in a little bit. And then we'll be here in town for a couple weeks. So looking forward to spending some time with our friends and family. And, of course, going to the greatest spectacle in racing, the 109th running of the Indianapolis 500. So today is the greatest day in motorsports, at least for this year it is. Started out this morning with Formula One. I don't have the results for that, but I will talk about qualifications from Monaco, and that race is now over. That was early this morning. We are actually right in the middle of the Indy 500 coverage over on ABC and ESPN. Excuse me, not ABC, Fox News, Fox broadcast on Channel 10 in Arizona. So that race is going on right now. And then the Coca-Cola 600 will be this evening, and that's a NASCAR race. So Formula One in the morning, that's already happened. IndyCar 500, Indianapolis 500 happening right now. And then this evening, the Coca-Cola 600. Greatest day in motorsports. The only difference next year, the Formula One race is actually moving a week later, the first weekend in June. So this is the last weekend for the biggest weekend of the year when it comes to car racing. So next, we're going to talk a little bit about the drama that has been happening here at Indianapolis. But about qualifying at Indianapolis, it's very unique. So on last Saturday, they had the first day of qualifications. The drivers that were the 12 fastest of that day got to move on to run for the pole position, which that is actually on Sunday. The slowest drivers, the slowest four drivers, went to the last row shootout. This year, we're looking for 33 cars to start the race. We actually had 34 cars, so one car is not going to make it. So at this point in time, we now move over to Sunday. We have half the field has qualified, and they can't do anything about it. Positions 13 through 30 are fixed. They have no chance to improve their location. But the guys in the top 12, they do. Those are the cars that will be running for the pole position. Move to Sunday, and we have the fastest 12 cars that are going to race for the pole, and then we have the slowest four cars that are going to race for the last three positions on the grid. And the headliner, Team Penske, pulled from the fast 12 as Indy 500 P7 and P12 is set. Well, the first half of the two phases of the Indianapolis qualifying procedure took place and set positions 7 through 12 on pole day. And then absolutely unexpected as all three Penske cars failed to turn a lap as a result of Scott McLaughlin's crash a few hours earlier and a failure to pass pre-qualification inspections for his teammates Joseph Newgarden and Will Power. Felix Rosenquist was the fastest, followed by Pato Award, Robert Schwartzman, Scott Dixon, Pato, Alex Palou, and Takuma Sato. Those are the six that will move into the final phase, and they will be qualifying for the front row. Now, what is set and done for this second part is AJ Foyt's Racing's David Malukas is in seventh, Arrow McLaren's Christian Lundgaard in eighth, Andretti Global's Marcus Ericsson in ninth, and the three Penske drivers led by Scott McLaughlin, Joseph Newgarden, and Will Power in 10th, 11th, and 12th. That's how we ended the day on Sunday, last Sunday, the 18th. And it was a really huge deal that the Penske guys got frankly caught doing something illegal to their cars. And as you'll hear moving forward, there's a big ramification coming from this penalty. So now we're running for the pole, and the headline says rookie Schwartzman and Prima Racing score shock with Indy 500 pole. Well, Prima Racing and rookie Robert Schwartzman are on the pole for the Indianapolis 500. Yeah, that's not a typo, a fan dream, or fan fiction. The biggest Indy 5 qualifying stunner of the century was delivered on Sunday evening by a driver who grew up doing nothing but road racing and has the fewest oval miles of any driver entered in the 109th running of the Indy 500. Well, the hometown fans were cheering him on like he was a native son of Indiana. The 25-year-old son of Israel buried his foot into the throttle for his V6 Chevrolet engine and skyrocketed to a four-lap average of 232.790 to clear Honda's driver, Takuma Sato, for Rahal Letterman Lanigan Racing at 232.478. So 232.79 versus 232.48, they were just that close. Well, in reality is that it was an incredible feat for a brand new team and a rookie driver to be on the pole at Indianapolis. On the outside of the front row, one of my favorite drivers, Pato O'Ward, and starting in third position. In fourth will be Scott Dixon. Felix Rosenquist will start in sixth. Alex Palou, your champion, your last year's champion and the current leader in the clubhouse right now as far as points, will start in the sixth position. David Malukas, as we had mentioned, will start in seventh. So that's the way we ended the day on Sunday with the qualification and the shock that a brand new team with a rookie driver is on the pole for the Indy 500. Monday morning, a very well-known motorsports writer named John Orvitz wrote a column called Sour Milk, and this is a year later, and he wrote this on the 19th. It says, well, I watched the last 20 laps of the 2024 Indy 500 the old-fashioned way from the infield with a view of the exit of Turn 1 as the laps wound down. I walked a little bit closer to the exit tunnel, no longer within sight of the big screen TV that was playing out with the action to the grandstands or unable to hear the track PA. All I could see was cars flash by 4 or 5 seconds through the south short chute, and the only clue I had who might be out in front for the next time coming around was the sound of the crowd lining turns 1 and 2 at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And for what I could hear and then see, a huge roar went up whenever Alexander Rossi or especially Pato O'Ward took the lead. Conversely, there was much more of a muted response, or was it a collective groan, every time that Joseph Newgarden, driving for Penske Motorsports, came to the front. After the last of the quiet waves, the cars came around slowly with Newgarden out in front, and I presumed it was for a caution at the other end of the track that I could not see. But no, Newgarden had actually won the race, and the crowd seemed underwhelmed. Now, walking through the tunnel out onto 16th Street, the immediate post-race atmosphere was more subdued than I can recall. I don't remember experiencing this perspective since 1978. Nobody was really talking about the finish of the race, despite what was being called by many an instant classic. Maybe it was in a lateness of the hour, the four-hour rain delay that pushed the finish back to nearly 8 p.m. Perhaps people were just eager to get home, dreading the traffic snarl they knew awaited them outside of the speedway. But there just didn't seem to be much of a post-race buzz. Now, a few of the folks who were talking about the racing were discussing the cheating scandal that had happened earlier in the year and embroiled Team Penske, especially Joseph Newgarden, who was stripped of the victory of the season opening race at St. Petersburg Grand Prix for illegally using the car's push-to-pass function during restarts. You probably remember that mess. IndyCar mistakenly identified during the pre-race warm-up at Long Beach that the three Penske cars driven by Newgarden, Scott McLaughlin, and Will Power had access to the push-to-pass at a time where the system was not supposed to be functioning. The subsequent research indicated that Newgarden and McLaughlin used the push-to-pass illegally during the St. Pete Grand Prix, resulting in both drivers being disqualified weeks after the fact. Newgarden's offense was much more egregious than McLaughlin's and Power, as Power didn't even use the button at all. He was docked points penalty. The four key members, including Team Penske's president, Tim Cindric, were suspended from IndyCar activity during the month of May last year at Indianapolis, and the team was fined $75,000 and forfeited about $100,000 in prize money. A team statement blamed the situation on a significant failure in our processes and our internal communication. Now, Roger Penske's teams have always sailed close to the wind and fate and tempted fate with the rulemakers going back to more than 70 years when he converted a Cooper Formula One car into a two-seat, allegedly, sports car called a Zurich Special. How about when they dipped their acid-dipped race cars in the 60s in the Trans Am to make them thinner and lighter? Mark Donohue, the driver associated with Team Penske's early success, often talked about chasing an unfair advantage. And how far would the modern Penske team go in that pursuit? Well, those days are mostly long forgotten. Until recently, given the team's pedigree and resources, no one questioned Team Penske's consistent excellence and success on the track. But there was that time when Joey Logano created a webbed glove that he held outside the window to gain an aerodynamic advantage during the NASCAR Cup qualifying in Atlanta, before Team Penske illegally used the push to pass in St. Pete. And Mark, another 6 weeks passed before that circumvention of the rules were discovered and revealed. These are complicated times for IndyCar racing. May be conflicted as a better description, given the Roger Penske's many conflicts of interest that have maybe finally caught up with him and now created a huge credibility problem for the sport that he literally owns. Penske wears a lot of hats when it comes to the victory photos to commemorate his record-setting 20th Indianapolis 500 win and the second consecutive for Newgarden. He's one, he's the Team Penske race team owner. He also is the co-owner of Ilmor Engineering, which manufactures the Chevy engines for the IndyCar Series. He is the IndyCar Series owner, and he is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway owner. Now, by all accounts, it was a thrilling race. It even generated ratings almost 10% up over year to year when IndyCar Series needs every eyeball it can reach. But given the way the race was resolved by Newgarden and Penske's favor, the lack of buzz in the crowd suggests that the hangover from the push-to-pass cheating scandal earlier in the year wasn't going away anytime soon. Well, there's a strong feeling within the paddock and amongst the fan base that Penske Empire holds too much power in the overall IndyCar equation. That penalty from IndyCar, which is owned by Penske, assessed against Team Penske, owned by Penske, not against Ilmor Engines and Chevy Engines, which is co-owned by Penske, are widely seen as one branch of the Penske family tree with a slight wrist slapping of the other. Now, Team Penske's handling of the matter got even worse at the public perception. Team President Tim Cindric blamed it on a line of code that accidentally left the software written for IndyCar hybrid component testing in the summer of 2023 and swears it wasn't on the cars used earlier. Let's say like 12 months earlier when Joseph Newgarden powered past Marcus Ericsson in a one-lap shootout to win the 2023 Indianapolis 500. Let's not even get into the controversial and unprecedented red flags that created the circumstance for Newgarden's first win. But now he has two, and Joseph Newgarden isn't the flawless golden boy that he was perceived to be just 12 months ago. It's hard to think of a reputation that has fallen faster. Newgarden has put himself at odds with many of his fellow drivers, even including his teammates. The breakup with his media marketing bus bros partner McLaughlin was stunningly public. McLaughlin seems to be a very likable bloke, as he could be. Newgarden's chest-bearing six-pack exposition in the 100 Days to Indy docu-series last year was soundly ridiculed, and many fans and competitors now think of him as arrogant and aloof. And his tearful explanation that he didn't understand the push-to-pass rules at St. Pete and Long Beach because he was allowed to use it all the time in the exhibition race at the Thermal was a universal disbelief. Newgarden has become IndyCar's resident villain. Unlike Denny Hamlin, he did it without really trying. Now, while the IndyCar arm of Penske conglomerate should be applauded for having the courage to air Team Penske's dirty laundry in public and assess a light penalty, well, who ever knows about how long Team Penske has been illegally using push-to-pass before the fluke accident caused them to get caught? If it took a mistake by IndyCar to discover this covert violation by Team Penske, what next mistake will be revealed? The calls for Roger Penske to divest himself from either his race team or the IndyCar series have grown stronger and louder. Obviously, RP is not going to give up his pride and joy, T Team Penske. But there is a rising belief that while the Indianapolis Motor Speedway looks good and the Indy 500 glides along like always, the series is being badly mismanaged under the guise of Penske Entertainment. In particular, the lack of continuity in replacing a car and an engine package that is now its 13th season in the competition of competition, and a remarkable failure for this series that boasts about engineering excellence and innovation. Now, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway president Doug Bowles recently quoted the Chicago Tribune saying 70% of our fans don't watch any other races all year long. Well, that shows that IMS is doing a remarkable job of creating a fan a place fan for loyalty, but it's truly alarming that IndyCar is not turning any of them into race fans who will travel to other events like Detroit or Iowa or tune into Laguna Seca or Nashville on TV. Fun fact, there were more people on the IMS grounds Sunday for the Indy 500 than the USA Network TV viewers nationally got at Long Beach Grand Prix, as billed as IndyCar's crown jewel. Penske Entertainment's near focus on the IMS and the Indy 500 while the rest of the series falters is reminiscent of the circumstances in the late 70s that prompted Roger Penske, Pat Patrick, and Dan Gurney to form CART to make IndyCar racing a successful year-long entity rather than a month of May phenomenon. It's a shame a few of those lessons were not learned when those two sanctioning bodies split. Clearly, the Speedway and the Indy 500 are deeply personal for Mr. Penske, but IndyCar racing as a whole seems to be just an expendable business. That attitude does not sit well with the other team owners. Now, embroiled in controversy with Team Penske Entertainment management and the series under serious criticism, frankly, it's a bad time for Team Penske to catch fire and do well on the racetrack. McLaughlin dominated at Barber, the first race after the push-to-pass scandal broke. Then Penske qualified 1-2-3 in the high-boost conditions of the Indy 500 last year, prompting more questions about the team's ability to manipulate the turbo-related software. The optics, should we say, are suboptimal. Now, of course, Team Penske and Roger Penske owns his 20th cherished Indy 500 triumph, courtesy of Newgarden, but it remains to be seen how this latest development settles in with uneasy with the fan base that's starting to make some noise about the lack of credibility on many levels, from Team Penske to its drivers to its leadership to IndyCar series management, and they say it's time for a greater separation of church and state. But ultimately, it's Roger's world, either love it or leave it. Well, that's a very telling article, and I don't disagree. One of the things I've been talking about for a long time is there's no other motorsport series where the person who owns the series has a race team that races in the series. The article was written on Monday, and Monday was the 19th. Now we move to Wednesday, the 21st, and the headline reads, Cindric Ruinsky, Moyer, depart Team Penske. Team Penske has implemented some drastic personnel changes ahead of this Sunday's Indy 500 in the wake of the technical violations found on two of its cars in qualifying last weekend. Team Penske announced today that the departures of IndyCar team president Tim Cindric, IndyCar team manager Ron Rzewski, and IndyCar general manager Kyle Moyer from the organization. A statement from the team read, Team Penske will have further announcements this week and related to personnel replacements for this week's Indy 500. According to team boss Roger Penske, he added, nothing is more important than the integrity of our sport and our race teams. We have had organizational failures in the last 2 years, and we have to make necessary changes. I apologize to our fans, our partners, and our organization for letting them down. So Roger Penske fires the three lead people in his IndyCar team to show that this means business, and there are some changes at Team Penske. So now we move to Friday. Friday is carb day, and it's the last day that they can test the cars before the Indy 500. Now, this is back in the day when the cars had carburetors. They're now all fuel-injected, turbocharged, but it's still called carb day. And I was actually at the track that day with friends and family, and I got a little bit of a sound from the track. See what you think about this. This is during the start of carb day. So those were sounds from Carb Day, and that is from the main straightaway. You can hear the cars going by. You can actually hear the PA announcers talking about some of the different cars, and Takuma Sato, who qualified on the front row, you heard his name mentioned as well. So the irony of ironies, Joseph Newgarden was the fastest car in practice on Friday. Even though he's going to be starting from the back of the field, he has a very, very fast car. And it'll be very interesting to see how he does in this year's 500. If he were able to come from the back of the field and win, he would be the first person to have won the Indy 500 3 years in a row. Just looked at the updated grid for the Indy 500. And right now, one of the big stories that I just failed to mention is we actually have Kyle Larson trying to do the double again this year, run the Indy 500 as well as the Coke 600. He qualified in 19th position for the Indy 500. And the final row is going to be Will Power, Joseph Newgarden, and Rinus VK. Will Power and Joseph Newgarden were fined and were penalized because of the issue with the failing pre-race inspection or pre-qualifying inspection. Formula One, even though I don't have the results yet, Lando Norris will start on the pole for McLaren. Charles Leclerc will start in second for Ferrari. Oscar Piastri will start in third for McLaren. And Lewis Hamilton will start in fourth position for Ferrari. And I will have the updated results from the Monaco Formula One Grand Prix next weekend. Well, last weekend, NASCAR was in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina. And Christopher Bell, driving for Joe Gibbs Racing, won the race. Joey Logano, who won the race last year, the All-Star Race, finishes in second. Ross Chastain in third. And Alex Bowman from Tucson, Arizona, finished in fourth. And next we're going to talk a little bit about the Coke 600 from Charlotte, which is going to be this evening. And that is going to be at 3 o'clock. And it's going to be on Amazon Prime, which is their first race of the season. Well, I consider this a little bit of a surprise. Chase Briscoe, who is on Joe Gibbs Racing, it's his first year with that team. He is starting on the pole position for tonight's running of the Coca-Cola 600. Kyle Larson, who qualified in second, who's going to be running the double. William Byron in third. Chris Buescher in fourth. A.J. Allmendinger will start in fifth position. And John Hunter Nemechek will start in the sixth position. I will have those results for you next weekend, and we'll talk more about what happened with Kyle Larson trying to run 1,100 miles, running the Indy 500 midday and running in the evening at the Coke 600 in Charlotte. Well, let's talk gas prices with our friends at AAA. So driving out, we left Arizona, went through New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, cut through Missouri, Illinois, and into Indiana. The least expensive gas we got was in Oklahoma, and that was $2.58 a gallon. Yeah, $2.58. All right, right now in Arizona, the average gas price is $3.36. New Mexico, $2.91. Texas, $2.76. Oklahoma, $2.80. Missouri, $2.85. Illinois, $3.43. And Indiana, $2.24. And I filled up the car today and I paid $3.35 here in Indiana. All right, let's see what's going on with gas prices in Arizona and Metro Phoenix. Well, right now, if you happen to be cruising through Yuma, you're going to get the cheapest price in the state at $2.54, and that is at the Circle K. If you live up in Prescott and you have a Costco card, how about this? $2.59 at Costco. The Circle K in Sierra Vista at $2.59. The TA Travel Center in Eloy at $2.59. And the Circle K in Huachuca City at $2.59 as well. All right, let's see what's going on in Metro Phoenix with our gas prices. Well, the least expensive gas in the Metro, well, that's going to be at Sam's Club on Dysart Road in Avondale at $2.95. Sam's Club on West McDowell in Phoenix at $2.95 as well. Let's see. The Arco Station on West Bell Road at $3.09. And the Costco on Market Street in Gilbert at $3.11. So right now, yeah, if you can find gas probably less than $3.20 a gallon in Metro Phoenix, that's a good price. Well, we've reached that time again. Time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I have a 2019 Ford Escape, and the engine has a timing chain. Now, I grew up as a backyard mechanic with my dad teaching me, so I understand the basics of how an engine works. My car just reached 100,000 miles, so I had all the fluids changed and new plugs installed. The manual also calls for inspecting the timing chain. I looked at online estimates to get the chain inspected, and they raised anywhere from $500 to $1,000. And then I looked up the cost of replacing the timing chain, and the estimates range from $500 to $1,500. Now, I haven't called my Ford dealer yet to get an actual price, but based on these estimates, why would I bother to have the chain inspected when it's about the same price to replace the chain? What's your thoughts? And that's from Jerry. Well, yeah, Jerry, you'd be nuts to pay $1,000 to have it inspected when you could replace it for just a little more than that. You'd also be nuts to replace it now for no reason at all. If you've taken good care of your engine, you changed your oil on time, you've driven it kindly, chances are the timing chain will last a lot longer than 100,000 miles. And we've seen plenty of well-maintained cars with 200,000 miles plus on them with their original timing chains. Now, the visual inspection of the timing chain is costly because you have to remove the water pump and the crankshaft pulley and the timing chain cover just to get to the timing chain. Now, there is a cheaper and a pretty darn good way to inspect the timing chain. Listen to it. If there's something wrong with the chain, the tensioner, or one of the followers, you can hear the chain slapping or jangling around the inside of its aluminum cover. It may not be something the average car owner would notice or even hear over the road noise and engine noise, but a good mechanic, well, they can get up close and they can listen to the chain and they can tell the difference between a normal engine noise and a chain that's starting to exhibit a problem. It's unlike a timing belt, there's no warning when it breaks. A timing chain will start to make noise hundreds and hundreds of miles before it actually will have the potential to fail. So that's what I'd recommend, Jerry. I'd find a good, experienced mechanic, one who's got a few gray hairs, and ask him to listen to your timing chain. If he starts talking about, if he starts talking back and having conversations with it, well, look for someone just a tiny bit younger. But if he doesn't hear anything concerning, then I would consider that your inspection. Yeah, and that those prices, wow, why would you even think about doing that when you want to make sure that the timing chain is working properly, but to get to it, it's going to cost you a lot of money to do a visual inspection. So I like this idea. Listen to it and then just watch. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. My name's Jeff Wine, and we'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.